When you need to focus on building, do you want to get bogged down by your database? MongoDB is an intuitive, flexible document database that lets you get to building. MongoDB's document model is a natural way to represent data so you can focus on what matters. MongoDB Atlas is the best way to use MongoDB. It's a global cloud database service that gives you all of the developer productivity of MongoDB, plus the added simplicity of a fully managed database service. You can get started free with MongoDB Atlas at mongodb.com/atlas.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, in breaking with my no Scott's rule, I've got Scott Berkin on the show, author of now his 8th book, How Design Makes the World. How are you, sir?
I am good. I am happy to be a rule breaker right off the bat. That makes me excited.
Too many Scots. But, you know, I've got, I think 5 or 6 of your books and 3 of them behind me on the shelves just right here.
Wow.
You went and became a best-selling author.
I did.
That is pretty fantastic. How many books are you doing? Are you doing a book a year? What's your schedule?
No. Well, I think I've averaged a book every 2 years because I quit Microsoft to try to become a writer in 2003. It's now 2020, 17 years, 8
books.
Oh,
wow. 8 books, yeah, every 2 years.
Close.
Are they all hard? Because the books that I've written are technical books. And at the beginning of the process of writing the book, I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll just bang this book out. This is going to be great. And then halfway through, I'm like, what have I done? You know,
well, it's always just fun starting a project, right? Because your ambition is really big and it's all in your head and the vision is grand. And then The work is always the work. No matter how great your vision is and your passion at the beginning, it's that's just the nature of creative projects, I think. But writing is hard. It's just you're taking on a lot of – you're trying to take on these huge burdens of covering a subject that you know really well and try to distill it down in a way that people can benefit from in a fraction of the time that it took you to learn all that stuff. That's just a cognitively an enormous challenge to do at all.
How do you decide on the length of your books? This book is a comfortable, roughly 200 pages. It's not a book that is weighty, that has a lot of emotional weight. We're like, I'm going to slog through this book. One of your other great books, The Year Without Pants. Also, it's a good, clean read, not a fast read. There's a lot of depth and a lot of density, but it's not 800 pages that you would hit someone over the head with. How do you decide? You could have made this book 10 times longer.
I don't know that I could anymore. I think of everything, that's what the book is about. Even talking about the book reveals some of the same topics that are in the book. Is it a book is a design thing? And you have to be thinking about, well, who are you designing for and who you're trying to reach? And for this book, I wanted to reach everybody. I wanted it to be a book that someone could read on an airplane, on a short flight, which we don't really have at the moment, but someday we'll fly again. And I wanted it to be a 2-hour read that required no preconditions, no prequalifiers, that you don't need any knowledge of design or engineering or anything to be able to get into the book. And so that was the goal. And a 200-page book is probably about a 3-hour read for most people, 2 to 3-hour read. That was my frame when I sat down to start working on the project.
That's a really good thing. Like, you're thinking about not just audience, but also context, which is really significant because every example in the entire book is about context because design only exists within context.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that's one of the lessons of the book is people think how design makes the world. Like, design is like fashion and like interior design. Like, isn't it a bit pretentious to claim that design makes the world or design makes a nation or anything like that? And that's what I try to do with the book is that word design, it's a verb that applies to everything. Our public transportation systems are designed. Our policies for healthcare and for criminal law, those things are designed. Borders between nations are design, when you really let it get its legs out there, is about everything. And the things that frustrate us or that disappoint us or that make us angry, they have those effects on us by design because someone created it and they are failing us. And so, I wanted to try to cover it as broadly and as intimately as I could possibly do.
No, the kind of ultimate example, or the oft-cited design book, would be The Design of Everyday Things by Norman, who you evoke within just a few pages because you share the Norman door. Maybe you could tell us what the Norman door is, and then I have a question about
it. Sure. Yeah, the Norman door is this classic example for anyone who works on product design of any kind. And it's in his book, and he talks about affordances. And affordance means how a design presents itself to you and what it suggests its behavior is. And so a door handle, if it has a handle like a handle on an umbrella, a rounded handle, that implies to any human being who lives in the modern world that it should be pulled. A Norman door is any door that has an affordance like that, but has a message on it that says the opposite, like push. So you can find these all over the place, doors that have confusing messages about how you interact with them. And it uses a canonical example for anyone interested in usability or good product design of any kind as a fundamental mistake that designers often make, or engineers often make when they're making UI for things, of not thinking through the mental models that people have and how to interact with them. And in writing this book, the burden I was taking on is really ambitious, a book that will explain good design to everybody. And I couldn't think of doing that without making some nod to the books that have done that before, tried to do something like that before. And when I did the research for this book, I asked everyone who I knew had an opinion about design, well, what's the first book you'd give to an executive or a manager or a client when you're trying to explain good design to them? And Design of Everyday Things was one of the ones that came up the most. So I'd read it before. I went back and read it again. And I felt like, well, this book has done a great deal of service to the whole community of trying to make things suck less, for sure. But the book itself is not really designed to solve that problem. It goes far too deep into cognitive psychology and how our memory works. It's really more of a guide for someone who's really going to spend a lot of time designing UI. So I included that example for two reasons. One, as a sort of homage to Don Norman and the work that he has done, but also to help everyone who knows that example get past it. So I introduce it, explain how this is an example of bad design. But if you go on Twitter, you'll find people who call out Norman doors all over the place with outrage. How could there be another Norman door? How could there be another parking lot meter that's hard to figure out? And there are really good reasons why there's so much bad design in the world. And so the next chapter, the second chapter, starts to unpack those reasons. Some of the reasons why Norman doors exist are about aesthetics, that the choices that people who do interior design or architecture make, they're trying to make a door that looks good or fits into the overall design of the building, or they'll make them that are make design. They'll choose doors that are glass with metal bars, which are more confusing, but it allows natural light into places. So there's actual trade-offs that are involved that explains why some of these things exist. And that's where I wanted to go with the book, to explain why bad design happens, because that's really, if we want more good design, it's not just like someone's being an idiot and designing a bad doorknob. There are structural and organizational reasons that lead those decisions to happen.
And in the middle of that, you called out something important, which was actually going to be my next question, but you answered it for me, which is it hard to write a book when a book is considered, that's the book, right? The Norman book is considered the book, but you're calling out that this is not that book. That book got really deep into, you know, the cognitive psychology of it. This book, I would have to say, is more accessible. I found it to be an easier read. There's a lot of density in that Norman book. Was it intimidating to go in and tackle this space when everyone, for right or wrong, thinks that the book has been written?
I think there's always, we all believe in progress, and progress happens when people are willing to take on the standard and say, you know what, there's a better way, or at least a different way that can be accessible to a different group of people or solve a different problem. One of my earlier books, Confessions of a Public Speaker, I did the same thing where I was told, you know what, there's already 100 books on public speaking. Why should there be another one? And like, that's the basis for creativity, is people who think they have a different approach to take. And so I have a lot of respect for Don Norman. He is truly a luminary and hero in the field. But that book is 20 years old, and it takes a certain approach by how he chose to design that book. And I'm going after I'm trying to solve a different problem. I want to invite everybody in to be thinking more clearly about good design.
Yeah. And I really feel like you did that. And I would even go so far as to say that I've shared this book with my 14-year-old. It is a very accessible book. And one of the things that I really appreciate about all your books, this one in particular, is you really give a sense of historical context. I wonder if you do that consciously. You always kind of call back to, here's a thing that I've identified. Here's a thing that I've researched. Here's some people who thought about that. And then you put it into a context kind of temporally. You're always going forward and backwards in the 20th century throughout this book, thinking about why this design happened, what the thinking behind it, and what was going on in the world when this thing happened.
I'm glad that you noticed that, because it takes a lot of work to pull that off. I think that it's grounding. I think that we're so fond of believing that it's a term Tom Standage, who writes for The Economist, uses, called chronocentric, that everything is new and we're the first group of people ever to face design problems or engineering problems. Mm-hmm. And that's just patently untrue. It's a shallow understanding of the history of your own field if you tend to think that way. And I think there's a power to stories when they come from further back in history. They are also more stable stories. If I were to write this book and all my examples are about the latest iPhone or the latest laptop, in a year, those stories are going to be out of date. They're not going to have any power or relevance anymore. But by carefully choosing interesting stories from the past that have power, those are stories that I hope and think will stay with people longer and be more applicable, because they'll be able to refer back to something that comes from a deeper place.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide about the story arc? Your chapters in this book, you've got about 20 chapters, and there's a bit of a bell curve there, and there's some discussion around design as a verb, and a great chapter called The Past in Your Pocket that I want to talk about in a little bit. How did you figure out how to end? How did you slide down the other side of the story arc?
Well, that is mostly about, I always have a rough outline. I have, as I'm thinking of the early draft of the book, there's usually ideas from 20, 30, 40 chapters. I do the same kind of project management technique any smart person would use. You make a big list and you start refining it, prioritizing it, mm-hmm. and then you write the first draft. And then in writing the first draft, you realize, all right, chapter 7 I thought was going to be great, and it sucks, so I'll rip that one out. And then chapter 9 and 10, you realize, you know what, they're separate now. Really, they should be merged. Like, you discover all these things through the iterative process of making stuff. So I do that a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but I don't know what the anchoring stories are going to be yet. I'll have guesses, but mm-hmm. it's only through the writing a whole draft and then reading it and giving it to beta readers to start to get a feel for it. That story just doesn't work here. So I either need to replace that story with a better one or rip out that part of the chapter. And so mm-hmm. I think the book ends. You're asking about the tail end of the bell curve. The book ends with a story, a chapter that talks about how solutions become problems. The designs that succeed because of their success generate problems. And all the first part of that chapter is about the medical community and what goes on mm-hmm. in a hospital room with all the alarms and the bells that compete with each other. I didn't come to that as being the anchor for setting up the last chapter until it was a late draft. It's probably draft 4 or 3 or 4. And mm-hmm. as I'm working, doing research, I make a huge document that's got all these cool stories in it, just reference from all the things I've been reading. And as I'm doing revisions, I mark each of the stories in that big document is marked with notes for where it might, what chapter it might work in. So as I am writing, if I get stuck and realize this story sucks, or the fact I thought was true, I did more research and I'm totally wrong, it's not true, so it doesn't work, I can go back to my notes and go, what else did I have that could tell the story of exclusion and gender bias in design? Oh, I can go back to that section and see if I have another story, and I can put it back in and see if it works.
And you get into, I think that's chapter 19, where you say solutions create problems. But then what I like about the book is when you think you're at the end, there's basically 20 pages of notes, of references, of other books to read. You share your entire process here, and you actually have a call to action to improve the design of the world. I love this one particular line that I highlighted. You said it's a big world, and this is a small book. You actually give a list of the things that we can do to kind of ask, and I like the way you phrased this, what can you ask of the things that you see around you? When you see a thing that is designed that doesn't meet your needs or that you feel some kind of way about, what do you ask of that object?
Yeah, I wanted to make it actionable. I think it's I think I'm good at storytelling. I think I'm good at structuring a narrative experience. People will hopefully say it's a good read, but I really have the ambition of I want a better design world. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work well that should. And the people who make stuff, and I know you from your career, we're around a lot of people who make stuff, developers and designers and entrepreneurs. Everyone who I know who wants to make stuff wants to make something good. So there's a gap there in their knowledge about it. And so I want anyone who makes it gets through the book and feels, ah, I think I see the world better. Well, I want them to have some tools for how they can apply that knowledge and ask better questions when they're in meetings or when they write a product review, think about it in a more critical way. Or I wanted to make what they get out of it something that's active and help them on their way.
One of the best questions that you ask that you mentioned a little bit at the beginning of our conversation is, what hidden constraints can explain this thing's weaknesses? I think a lot of us just assume that, well, the only explanation for why this is this way is because the people who made it are idiots. But there are other hidden constraints.
Yeah, there is. Although, you know, I don't want to defend idiocy. Well, is a problem. Idiots,
to be clear,
idiocy is a problem. But we all kind of know it in our own lives that when we work on projects, we know that we didn't get enough budget, and that's why it's not that great. Or there was a political fight between one department head and another, or our teammates weren't useful. We know at work for ourselves, how many of the constraints that limit the quality of the work that we can make on projects is really about all these tough things that are hard. But when you are in the world as a person using things, we're not really interested in being generous to these teams we don't know about. So we take it at face value. When there's a confusing intersection that we drive through or we miss an exit because the sign wasn't clear, you know, we're rightfully mad because we're living in the world with that experience. But that anger about a stupid design, you don't learn anything from just assuming the team was stupid. There's far more lessons to be discovered if you go, wait a second, let me find out why that sign was made that way. Like, what's the story behind this design failure? That's really where you start to learn. Just flippantly saying something is terrible or flippantly saying something was great without starting to ask questions, you don't really learn anything. And I really wanted this to be a book that people, even just one chapter on its own, people will go, oh, now I can see why maybe this thing I experienced last month or a year ago, or this thing that frustrates me now, I'm starting to get some insight into what's really going on.
You know, a really great example of exactly what you just said is chapter 12, where you talk about an airplane boarding pass, and you show kind of the classic Delta, you know, airplane boarding pass, and it's not really interesting or useful. It's just a boarding pass, right? And then you call out an example of a very talented designer who went through and redesigned it. And then you show the more readable, more attractive boarding pass, and you look at it and you go, oh my God, this is gorgeous. Like, this is amazing. We all need this boarding pass. But then you look at it and you're like, wow, it's a lot less readable. It's kind of like a Star Trek, you know, LCARS kind of interface. I don't really like, where am I sitting? I don't even know where the seat is. It's initially gorgeous, but what is the word for these kind of redesigns?
Drive-by redesign.
Right. He re-jumped in. The whole team did a bunch of research. He applied his excellent eye. It's a gorgeous thing, but it's not better.
Yeah. Well, the chapter gets into why it's just impossible. Like the drive-by design thing, I think, is a phenomenon of any creator on Twitter or Facebook where they use something and they see a terrible logo, or as a software developer, they use something that just is very slow and buggy. And then on Twitter, they're just, I could design a better one. I could do a better one. And they just start typing what they would do that would be so much. It's so obvious from the outside. And so this example, the boarding pass, is a great one because we do this all the time. We redesign things on our own, or we watch the last Star Wars movie and we're like, oh, I could have written a better script. And we just presume that it's all superficial and obvious. In the case of the boarding pass design, the real constraint of why boarding passes look the way they do, and this is true also for like If you fill out a medical form or an insurance form that's confusing, there's often constraints that have to do with how they're printed, what printing services are available at that scale. And so it turns out that in most airports, there's a limited set of printers that were installed in the late 80s, mm-hmm. mostly, that have limited abilities. They're not dot matrix printers, but they can't do multicolor. Mm-hmm. There's limits on the sizing options that they have. And so mm-hmm. the constraints are purely physical. They're about bits and they're about atoms. And that's why those boarding passes are designed the way that they are, because the costs of putting in new printers in every gate in every airport would be astronomical. And this is where designers and engineers, you start thinking through constraints now that, yes, maybe you could design something that was better in one way, but the expense of it to actually achieve that, given all the logistics required, would be make mm-hmm. it ridiculously unaffordable. And so what is design then? Is design then this abstract commentary that we offer things? Or mm-hmm. are we in the real world where to really make a better boarding pass, you have to deal with the real constraints? And it's often way more fun to skip over the real constraints and just pretend like, well, I could do a better job. I'm going to make fun of this thing I just saw on social media.
We see that a lot when we see people go and redesign Mac or redesign Windows, or they say, why doesn't the start menu look like this? And I'm usually, even though I work at Microsoft right now, I go and say, oh my God, we need to stop everything and we need to redesign the start menu to look like that.
Yeah.
But again, it doesn't think about the billion people using the thing, the usability, the inclusion, the accessibility constraints. There are a ton of hidden constraints that designers face. And I think, as you said before, we just tend to go, well, it should just be like this and it should just be like that. It's very, very human to minimize the complexity of a thing.
Yeah, especially when you don't actually have to do the work. You're just driving by. This is for 5 minutes. You're going to rail against how stupid the people at Microsoft or Google, how dumb they are that they design it this way. And then you move on in your life and you never have to actually discover how much harder it is to do these things than it seems from the outside. Mm-hmm.
Hey, friends, I want to thank one of our sponsors, the company Text Control. They're the creator of TX Text Control. It's a Microsoft Word-inspired document editor library. It's basically a document processing engine for your web applications. They've got libraries for ASP.NET MVC, for Angular, for Node.js, and they just released a .NET Core version. It lets you basically integrate a WYSIWYG document editor into your web applications. You can edit docs, you can do merge templates, you can include data, you can even create Adobe PDF documents with a fully featured API. It's really pretty amazing. You can try it free, and I encourage you to check out the live demos at textcontrol.com/demos. Textcontrol.com/demos. It's really pretty amazing piece of work. Do you think that the closed door button in an elevator does anything? Or have you done the research and confirmed that it in fact does not?
I did all the research. So I confirmed that it really depends, but in most cases they don't do anything. In the United States, the reason is in part because of the American Disabilities Act, and that required that doors stay open long enough that someone on a wheelchair or on crutches or who's just older and a little slow has time to get to the door. Up until then, they probably worked more often, but in general, these things are called what are called placebo buttons. That, like a placebo, your mind may
they make you feel good.
Right. Your mind may think that it's actually doing something, which can have an actual beneficial effect on your experience. But in reality, that button doesn't do anything. So crosswalk buttons at intersections are another common example. The wiring to maintain those is expensive. And also the traffic systems in many cities are controlled based on time of day and other factors. And if they incorporated individual user commands into that system, it would just be untenable and it wouldn't work. And then,
right. But it would feel weird. It wouldn't match my mental model if there was only an open button, because you need two sides. You need open and closed.
Yeah. And it's people complain, why isn't there a closed door button? So what are you going to do if you're the person that you're the superintendent of a building? You put in a closed door button and now people are happy because it lights up, even though it doesn't do anything. That's way cheaper. It solves the problem, but it's way cheaper than actually having to to do engineering and wiring. And actually, elevator control systems are fascinating in a way because they're not controlled by the elevator. They're controlled in some cases by the whole master system that links together how which the elevators are going to go where. And elevators are, talk about constraints. Elevator design has way more complications than most people think that they do.
The point that you made about complaints and how people complain, there was another great story when we were thinking about mental models and people were complaining. So the design change was to move when someone lands and they want to go get their bags at the baggage system to move the carousel far away because people were complaining that they'd show up and they'd, where are my bags? Why is moving it far away fixing?
This is a fascinating story. And it's a fascinating story in part because it's probably not entirely true. Now, when I do research, I wrote a book on the myths of innovation, which is all about showing all these things we think we commonly know about creativity and innovation, that many of those stories are terribly mistold and unfounded and not really based on actual evidence for things. Like Newton's apple is a very contentious story when it comes to history and how all that stuff gets told. So I try to keep a really high bar for anything I include. That story was written in the New York Times in the early 1990s about an airport in Dallas, although they never say which specific airport, which is usually a problem. But as the story goes, I'll tell it as it's usually told. They were having complaints about how long people had to wait. And what they had tried at first were different options for like speeding up baggage handling and automating the systems. They tried all the logical, rational approaches, but it didn't help enough. People were still complaining. So as this story is told, what they did instead was something that seems irrational. What they did instead was they made it so that the walk to get – when you get from the gate, the walk from your gate to where your bags are was longer. And by making it longer, it made it so that there was more time for your bags to arrive. So the percentage of time when you got to where the baggage were – the baggage claim area number 5, the bags were there and people stopped complaining. Even though it took longer – there's something about our mental models for how time passes. As when we wait for things, we get irritated. But if we are walking to a place and the stuff is there, we feel good. And this was in the chapter, just reflect that engineers and people who are very smart and rational, we try to solve problems rationally. We want to really solve the problem. But our brains don't work that way all the time. People who are users and consumers and customers, their relationship to rationality, we're more emotional creatures, and our perceptions of time are not as rigorous as engineers tend to think. So the lesson from that story, even if it's not entirely true, is that by understanding human psychology, you need to understand human psychology better in order to design and engineer things better for people. If you're not doing that, you're going to make the mistake of trying to solve the problem one way when there's a much easier approach that's just as good that requires a lot less effort and a lot less work.
Mm-hmm. And there's a ton of people out there who think about waiting, like time and temporal management, how people think and how people experience time. That's a whole world of psychology. Like that's designing so that we don't get irritated, whether it be waiting in line at Disneyland or on an elevator or at the DMV. All of those things, you want to basically reduce the anxiety of the people waiting in line.
Yeah. And so that's Disney World's a fantastic example because people don't think of it this way, and Disney would never advertise their amusement parks this way, but they're really not amusement parks. They're more like waiting in line parks. You spend most of your time waiting in line, but they've made a whole bunch of very big investments to make that entertaining and pleasant and as fun. There's interactive things along the way. You can get food. They also give you estimated wait times, which is a smart thing to do, and the estimated wait times are always inflated as much as possible. So even though you thought you were going to wait 45 minutes, if you only wait 30 minutes, you feel like you got a good deal. And that's, again, about anchoring, a principle about psychology that when you anchor something, could be the price of the most expensive food item on a menu, it sets your perspective for what good, bad, and great are. And so that's another technique that they could have spent all this time trying to really figure out, maybe we can have 5 roller coasters go at the same time, one after another, and we can up the speed of the engineering capacity of the system. Or, well, let's focus on psychology, let's design for psychology and make it better. So I think the door open or close button, you might not need that if it said closing in 5 seconds, 4 seconds, 3, if it actually gave you a time estimate. Also, when you're waiting for an elevator, same thing. You push that button and then it lights up. And then we all push it again and we push it again and we push it again. Like it's entirely irrational. the button is lit. Like, we know the system knows that we want it, but yet we still feel like if we don't do something, because we don't know. But if it said estimated time for next car, you know, 2.5 minutes, we'd be like, all right, I'll just read an article on my phone. We know that we're being taken care of.
I feel like we need to go and fix the Windows Explorer file copy dialog, because when they estimate the time that's going to, you know, this file copy is going to take a month, you know, I don't feel like I'm winning when it only takes 5 minutes. And there's no, but there's no placebo button. The I really mean it. Please click, you know, no, I really want to copy that. I need that. One of the last things I want to ask you about is that you call out some broken organizational problems that need to be overcome, designed by dysfunction, designed by committee, and designed by regulation. Maybe you could share those problems and why solving them is so important.
Well, I think that gets back to constraints, that when we use something that frustrates us, we have in our head that there was just one overlord on the project that controlled every decision that was made. And the reason why the thing is bad is because that person was an idiot. Yet in our own world, our own working world, we know there's a head of engineering. There's a head of project management for every product team, right? There's a head of engineering. There's a head of program management. There's a head of testing if you have quality assurance. There's a head of marketing. And if the head of engineering and the head of the design team or the head of the project management team hate each other, that's going to ripple down through the organization in all kinds of dysfunctional ways. There's not going to be respect for the contributions of different roles and different people with different knowledge have. There's not going to be a healthy schedule process, because there's going to be fighting and infighting over which things get prioritized if the goals aren't clear. So I think that usually it's possibly the primary reason why so much of the world is, so many things in the world are poorly designed, is most organizations don't work very well. They are dysfunctional. People don't communicate well, or decisions are not made clearly, or there isn't a good vision, or there's 1,000 things that have to be done well to make an organization a healthy place. And it's hard to do. But even though it's hard to do, you can't expect an organization that's just bad at making good decisions to make good design decisions. That's just improbable. Design is one of many kinds of decisions that an organization has to make. And I think one of my critiques of many books on design, including Design of Everyday Things and Steve Krug's Don't Make Me Think, there are many great books about design. They rarely go to these places that are the fundamental reasons why things end up as in the product as not working well. It's about how the project team is led, how it's managed, where does the budget come from. You can't really worry about your design or usability expert's ability to contribute if there's no budget for it, and if the schedule's a mess and there's no time for it. So there's fundamentals to just projects that are integral to thinking about how good design of any kind happens.
Mm-hmm. So dysfunctional teams don't work. Design by committee basically means design by consensus.
Yes.
People just trying to come up with the least awesome possible solution. And then, of course, design by regulation can almost suck the life out of design completely.
For sure. Yeah. And that's anything that we see, it's in the public, like traffic design, traffic sign design, like the highway signs you see, public transportation systems, and whether there's a bus stop a block from your house or 50 blocks from your house. There's a lot of regulation and public process that goes into making any kind of design change. We're getting design approvals. And we like to make fun of – some people like to make fun who work in the private sector of how clumsy and foolhardy government projects can be. But part of it is the challenge of those constraints, many of which were created for a good reason. But managing those constraints effectively now becomes as big a challenge as coming up with the ideas and developing them is as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to my particular favorite chapter is the one on design as it flows, with regards to how people move through space, how people move through airports, garages. Transportation is a whole design issue
to
think about as well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Scott Berkin, for chatting with me today about your book, How Design Makes the World. I really enjoyed it very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Thanks for having me on. It was a great conversation. It was a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.